14, 62 degrees at WTMJ. Joining us on our Tri-County Contracting Hotline is former Congressman Scott Klug. Now, he hosts a podcast called Lost in the Middle, America's Political Orphans. And I think, Scott, a lot of people are feeling like they're political orphans this morning, especially in light of that conviction of President Trump.
Yeah, I mean, I think it just puts a big question mark over where the unsettled are, right? If you look, there's a big chunk of people in this country who really don't even want to see a Trump-Biden rematch, and it's a little hard to figure out early on what kind of wrench this throws into their voting plans. But I think, you know, it's hard to see where this goes. I think it's one more little mark on a sheet when people are trying to figure out this guy or that guy. So it'll be interesting to see how it develops over the next couple months, Libby.
Were you surprised at the reaction of a lot of Republican leaders? I mean, we even had former Vice President Pence saying nice things, or no, I don't want to say nice things, but certainly he was a little upset by the conviction.
Cards on the table. I'm not a Trump guy and never will be a Trump guy. I did think that the underlying case was a little weird, right? So mm-hmm. It's violations of tax law because they tried to hide what the real, you know, they really weren't legitimate business expenses. So that turns into a very low-level tax felony, if it even is a felony. But the underlying thesis was it was done to essentially be an illegal contribution to the Trump presidential campaign because the money was used to shut down a story they didn't want, then that should be a federal election commission. It's an election law violation. It's not a tax matter. So it's a pretty convoluted case. But, you know, at the end of the day, he got convicted, and I'm going to take the New York members of the jury at their word. I mean, I've served on jury duty twice, and people take it very, very seriously, despite the fact all of us always try to get out of it. So I just think you have to, you know, say the system worked the way the system worked and sort of bite the bullet and move on.
Yeah, but I mean, a lot of people who have not been Trump fans still are somewhat coming to the defense of the fact that this was a very weak case.
Yeah, I think of all the cases that are out there, it was the weakest. The one that I think is the easiest to prove is the obstruction of justice with the documents he held onto. I mean, it's pretty clear. I send you a subpoena, you're supposed to turn them over. And if you're telling somebody to hide boxes of stuff in the basement, it seems to me that's like a 10-minute trial. I think that one got complicated because the prosecutor threw in a bunch of stuff about the presidential records law, which is just going to, I mean, I don't think anybody understands them. And the first thing the defense lawyer is going to say is, how come Joe Biden wasn't charged with the same thing? And the answer is, well, because he didn't refuse to comply with a subpoena. The Georgia one is bizarre. And then for anybody who knows anything about racketeering cases, they're very powerful. They're easy to prove because you only have to prove a handful of overt acts between all of the, how many people were charged, 32 or whatever it is. How are you going to try 32 people in a courtroom? And if each has two lawyers and there's a prosecutor case, you're going to have to do it in the Georgia dome. So, and given the foibles of the prosecutor who is completely mixed up her personal life with a professional life, I think that was the most riskiest for Trump, the most serious charges, and it's state racketeering laws, which have some pretty hefty sentences connected to them if you're convicted. But I'm not sure that case is ever going to see trial anymore. And obviously, because it's another state conviction, a president can theoretically pardon himself of federal crimes, although the Supreme Court's not ruled on it yet. But for the sake of argument, say they could. They clearly can't wipe out the New York state charges, nor could they wipe out the Georgia case if it ever comes to trial.
But this whole thing has gotten so bizarre. I mean, if you think 20, 30 years ago, people saying that this would happen to a former president, I don't think anybody would have believed it. They would have said, oh, that's made up, that's a book, that's a movie. How did we get here?
Well, for all your listeners, it's lostmiddle.com's the podcast, and I think the question everybody in the middle asks is, out of a population of 320 million people, how in God's name did this end up as our choice? And you know that. So back to your fundamental question, though, is how does this impact the election? It really doesn't matter nationally. What it really matters, if you look, for example, NBC says there's essentially seven counties that will tell you who wins the election in November. It's Miami-Dade County. It's suburban Atlanta. It's Grand Rapids, Michigan. That used to be very Republican, a little more purple. It's Maricopa County, Arizona. That's the swingiest county in battleground Arizona. It's Erie, Pennsylvania. It's actually Dane County, Wisconsin. And Dane County is interesting, says the guy who used to represent Dane County as a Republican. It's become increasingly Democratic. But what really matters in Dane County is, are students going to show up? I mean, do they care about the Trump conviction? Do they worry about what's going on in Gaza? Are they worrying about whether they get jobs over the election in a market that still seems a little bit soft? So, you know, sort of what happens in national polling is irrelevant. What really matters is where swing voters are. And as it's been for the last, my God, 40 years, it's the swing voters in the swing states. And even in the swing states, it's not the whole state. It could literally come down, if you believe NBC News, seven counties that will serve as a marker in it. And one of them's in Wisconsin.
Well, and that's one of the reasons I want you here, because you were reelected a number of times by people that are kind of in that middle. They don't feel very strongly about being Republican or about being Democratic. And yet you know those people best. You certainly appealed to them. What is the key? What's the key to this? I mean, yeah, they're lost in the middle. They don't know which way to go. They're not happy with Biden. They're not happy with Trump. Certainly this casts a pall over the election where you have one of the candidates convicted of felonies. Where will they go with this information?
I don't have the faintest clue. And the answer is neither do the campaigns. And that's going to be the jockeying, I think, over the next 3 months to see who can toggle to the middle. You know, there's some warning lights out there flashing for Trump. I mean, the warning lights are clearly that, you know, suburban voters, swing voters aren't big fans. I mean, if you look at New Hampshire, which has one of the largest blocks of independent voters called unaffiliated voters in New Hampshire, 70% of Nikki Haley's voters were swing independent voters, the people in the middle. If you look at Biden, I mean, Biden's got a huge issue with students who don't particularly like him, don't find him very engaging. The black and the Latino community seem to be shifting a little more right. So it's very much sort of a swirling sauce in a blender right now, and I can't figure it out. But I think what people really want is not necessarily to have permission to have politicians compromise. I think the operative word is they want them to collaborate. And, you know, you and me, and we'll get a pad of paper, and we'll go down to the closest George Webb to TMJ and pull eight people aside at a table and ask them to pencil out the rough outline of an immigration deal. I mean, people want more security on the border. People want a path for, you know, the kids who came here with their parents who've only grown up in the United States. You know, I was watching a crew put a new roof on a building, a house across from me about a month ago, and everybody was working there was Hispanic and a couple of the guys from Mexico because I talked to them. So you get a rough outline, right? So earlier this year, they get a deal in the Senate. It goes to the House. Trump doesn't want it to pass because he wants it as an election issue. So that weekend on Meet the Press and CBS Morning News, everybody's pounding on Republicans. If you play the tape and rewind, we can go to 2006 where George Bush says the greatest failure of his presidency and his greatest disappointment, they didn't get an immigration deal because in 2006, the Republicans cut the deal and Schumer and the Democrats stopped it because Barack Obama wanted it as an election issue in the other direction. And I think that's what drives people crazy. It's a pox on both your houses. We elected you to go there, do common sense things. And meanwhile, you know, there's a fight in Congress over false eyelashes 3 weeks ago. There's a U.S. senator asking the head of the Teamsters to step out in the hallway to duke it out over who's the toughest guy in the building. And people are just shaking their head. It's like, who elected these people? With everything we've got to do in this country, the Republicans are running around taking middle school books off shelves, and the Democrats are trying to take the gas stove out of your kitchen. I mean, it's a comedy, and it's a very sad comedy, and I think the middle is just perplexed and bewildered by how we got here.
We are talking with former Congressman Scott Klug. His podcast is called Lost in the Middle, America's Political Orphans. We're going to talk a little bit about that, and also I want to find out from Scott what he thinks the atmosphere will be like at the RNC here in Milwaukee in just a couple weeks. It's all ahead on Wisconsin Weekend Morning News. back with former Congressman Scott Klug. His podcast is called Lost in the Middle, America's Political Orphans. We'll tell you about that in just a second. But we've got the RNC coming up in just a couple of weeks. What is it, 5 weeks off, I think, Scott? And a couple days before it sets off, they're going to be sentencing the former president. How is this going to affect what is traditionally a party-like atmosphere at a national convention?
Oh, I think it will whip up the Trump supporters, and I suspect you'll see a lot of emotion pent up supporting Trump from people who thought he was convicted wrongfully. And so I don't think it's going to change the mood in the building. It may make it a little less celebratory and a lot more rallying around Trump to get things done. I think it's going to put people in a very battle-hardened mood. The conventions, you know, really haven't been real conventions since before I was in politics. I mean, there's been no drama. They're wired deals. I can remember going to the Republican convention in Philadelphia, and they had to fill 3 days. And so what you end up for 2 days are people just doing 5 minutes of speeches, and they literally have entertainment to fill the dead spot. So I can remember sitting at the Republican convention in Philadelphia watching the OJs play in the middle of the afternoon, which, since I was an OJs fan, was a great way to spend the day. You know, with conventions, what you really could do is shorten it down just to the vice president's speech and the president's speech. That's all that really matters. And the drama that will circle around who Trump's going to pick as his VP candidate.
And that's what I wanted to ask you is, do you think some of the leading contenders will now distance themselves, or is this going to bring more people into the mix in terms of who wants to be his running mate?
Well, I don't think it changes it at all. I mean, I think if you've looked sort of one national leader at a time and one potential VP candidates have all rallied around Trump and sort of closed ranks. You know, although it's interesting, a lot of folks, I think you can make the rational argument, are doing it, not that they're Trump fans, but they want to avoid a primary with Trump supporters. And so you've seen a lot of Senate candidates who I think naturally wouldn't do it. The only person I think who's picked the fight pretty publicly is Larry Hogan, who's the former governor of Maryland, who's now running as a Republican in a very Democratic state. But he was extraordinarily popular, and he's running ads actually featuring Republicans and Democrats talking about what a great governor was. So I'm disappointed there aren't more people who will distance themselves from the president. I mean, I just have a hard time, given his personal conduct, being able to rally around him. And I know that won't buy me a lot of Republican fans listening to the radio right now, but I think you got to be a straight shooter and call it the way you see it.
Any thoughts on who will be the running mate?
I don't, Libby. I mean, I think for a long time, people thought Kristi Noem would be the candidate. You know, attractive, smart, articulate governor from South Dakota. I think she's sort of fallen off the radar screen. You know, if he's going to go for a woman, maybe Stefaniak, who's a congresswoman from New York, who was involved in a lot of the fights with the presidents of universities over anti-Semitism, she might be a good dark horse candidate. Maybe Tim Scott, who's a senator from South Carolina, who originally ran against him in the primary, who has now rallied to the president's defense on the recent convictions. In my mind, those are probably the two leading candidates, but I think he is a master showman and likes to keep it in suspense. And I don't think we'll know much until maybe the weekend leading into the convention.
Well, the one thing we do know is there are a lot of people who are feeling somewhat alienated and they're lost in the middle, Scott. And you address that in your podcast, Lost in the Middle, America's Political Orphans. Tell us where we can hear that.
Well, you can download it. You have to put lostmiddle.com. It's a monthly storytelling podcast. So we just are working on run right now about reform ideas and whether they make sense, things like redistricting and final five voting and open primaries. Before that, we just actually tackled political stereotypes and had a lot of fun because Republicans hate California and California hates Democrats. And if you think about the stereotypes of those two states, that'll tell you a lot about the state of American politics. And we actually had fun with it because we used a lot of Texas comedians making fun of California and California comedians making fun of Texas. But it tells you a lot about the country at this point that we rely so heavily on stereotypes. And I think it's now, it's north of 60% of people in this country don't want their son or daughter to marry somebody who belongs to a different political party. I mean, it used to be churches, right? Catholics and Lutherans, you know, Jewish and Christians. You know, there's a lot of harshness there. But really, you don't want to have somebody marry somebody just based on their political affiliation. So that's how wacky it's gotten in the country. And my sense is, people, it's like, chill out and wake up. And so if you're feeling lost, rudderless, confused, and bewildered, please download it. As they always say, any place you get your podcast, it's available.
Lost in the Middle, America's Political Orphans, and, of course, the host, Scott Klug. Thank you so much for being here, Scott.
Thanks, Libby. Have a great Sunday. Appreciate the invitation.
You too.